Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest, and it's my honor, is Joyce Carol Oates. I've known Joyce Carol Oates since I was 17 years old. Now, that's not continuous knowledge, but it is a very profound memory. And her newest novel, The Man Without a Shadow, is about a man who loses access. He has had a form of encephalitis, yes, that's inflamed a part of his brain, so his current memory is inaccessible to him. He loses it within 70 seconds. His name is Elihu Hoops.
Hoops, yes.
And it's about his relationship with a woman named Margot Sharp, who is a very well-praised entering graduate student in the program that's studying the case of E.H. Elihu Hoops. And I've had a theory, it's long-lasting, that if you read the work of Joyce Carol Oates as it appears as arcs of stories, arcs of novel, story, essay, poem, that you'll start to see patterns forming of what interests her. And so in addition to The Man Without a Shadow, another book about memory, The Lost Landscape, just was published. It's The Childhood, A Writer's Coming of Age of Joyce Carol Oates. And I found it to be a fascinating book, and I guess I'm a glutton. And so I called the publisher of her next book, which is The Doll Master and Other Tales of Terror. And I discovered in the opening story in that book, a man who's the death of whose cousin inflicts him with a subsequent need for the control of young girls. So I found, as usual, that you've been thinking about memory and loss and how easy it is to lose everything one has stored and how dangerous that would be, particularly for a writer, yes?
Yes, I think you're quite right about these clusters of themes. I wasn't particularly conscious of it at the time. And I think, well, when something happens in our lives, maybe unconscious forces crystallize around a theme or an image. And so I felt at the time that my parents died, which is some years ago now, I felt that I had enough material to write for the rest of my life just about losing my parents and how profound that was, really unexpectedly profound and deeply moving. And I had so much to write about them and so much to say. And little did I know that was just one episode in losing things.
Now tell me, the original of Elihu Hoops, how did you encounter him?
Well, Elihu Hoops who's called E.H. in the novel, is a composite figure. That is, he's based upon several possible subjects. When neuroscientists and neurologists work with amnesiac subjects, they usually are working with someone suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia from alcoholism. In other words, a person whose general intelligence has deteriorated. But in this case, there's a subject who is reasonably young and healthy and has much of his memory intact, and he can be studied in a way that these other people can't be, because he's not completely deteriorated. It's just a small part of the brain that was affected in my novel. It's the hippocampus, very small part of the brain. But that affects our ability to form long-term memory. When something happens around us, it enters our brain through various senses, and depending upon the health and the vitality of the hippocampus, it is then stored into the brain and other parts of the brain in long-term memory. But if the hippocampus has been injured or atrophied or there's some illness, the ability of this part of the brain to form long-term memory is affected. So in the novel, my character can only remember things for about 70 seconds.
And because he is intelligent, he has some kind of knowledge that people grow weary of reintroducing themselves, and he has a very personable way of greeting, of saying hello. And this young woman, Margot Sharp, gradually becomes transfixed by him. She likes him very much. She has more sympathy for him than do the other graduate students. She'll sit and talk to him. She'll hold his hand. She'll look carefully at his drawings and his charcoals. And so she begins to feel, perhaps imagine, perhaps dream, that there's a special way he has of communicating with her, that he looks forward to seeing her especially, and she develops her own internal love affair with him. In fact, it's she who's being studied by the novelist here.
Well, that's an interesting insight. I thought I was charting also the process of falling in love that we present to the other selected images and memories of ourselves. We make up little narratives about ourselves. We're trying to interest and excite or present ourselves as mysterious to the other person. And so while she is presenting herself to him, he's subsequently forgetting her. So each time she meets him, for him it's the first time. For her, she is gradually falling in love. But she gets the idea, which I thought was brilliant, not just because it's my own idea, but she gets the idea of trying to simulate in his memory, his long-term memory, which is intact, some evoking of a person whom he might have known when he was much younger. In other words, she sort of does some investigation into his life. She does resemble, to some degree, some girl he went to grade school with, and she can build upon that. Now, we all remember people with whom we went to grade school to some extent. We have a dim, shadowy memory, and it may be layered with emotion, because when we're young, we have many emotions, and we're easily excitable. And there's a powerful sense of nostalgia for when we were school children. So if you thought you were meeting someone from third grade who now is 45 years old, you wouldn't expect the person to look quite like that person, but you would have those memories and an emotional sort of catharsis directed toward this person. So she's trying to evoke that in him. And I think that when people fall in love in a normal way, they're always trying to evoke some deeper memory in the other. And love is so much a mysterious and unfathomable process. why we may meet 100 people and like them but not fall in love with them, but the 101st person we fall in love with, why does that happen? It can only be for these unconscious reasons.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel, The Man Without a Shadow. Margot has devoted herself entirely to the study of this man, E.H. Elihu Eli Hoop. What progress Margot makes in the world is progress that she makes with Eli. She comes to have very protective ideas about him, and she genuinely loves him. And he is without love. The sadness of these people seems to lie outside of science, in the sadness of the human condition, of people who, through accident, through devotion to work, leave behind the possibility of human intimacy, yes?
Yes, but Margot does fall in love with him genuinely, and she wants to protect him. And I think when we love someone who's beginning to be impaired, who doesn't remember as much as he once did, we become very protective. You know, as the whole nation grows older, and the whole world, I guess, is growing older, it will be more and more the case that people in intense emotional relationships are with someone who will start to lose a memory. So as this person starts to lose his or her memory, you're starting to lose the spouse or the lover whom you once knew. However, I think we discover in ourselves a protectiveness, almost in the woman a maternal feeling, as the man is no longer able to remember quite as much as he did. I mean, I know many people, married people, who already, they're not that old, but they're supplying one another's, they're finishing one another's sentences for them. Like somebody is trying to remember the name of some person or some place where they've been, and the other spouse will supply it. So the two of them are kind of complementing each other. And that's completely normal. So my character is basically along a spectrum of apparent deterioration of memory, and yet it's a spectrum that shades into normal behavior.
I found in the very book before this one, the new book is The Man Without a Shadow, the previous book was a memoir, The Lost Landscape, A Writer's Coming of Age, and the extraordinary quality of innocent memories, memories you can't help but collect, acquire, maintain, polish with some regularity, is present there. And toward the end of the book, there's an extraordinary memory of the kinds of things we all ate as children that maybe we didn't know were bad for us, maybe our parents didn't know were bad for us, but grease everywhere.
Grease everywhere, that's right.
And breaded things. And I remember an advertisement for something called Sugar Pops, that went something like, oh, the pops are sweeter and the taste is new. They're shot with sugar through and through.
Ooh, ooh.
Sugar Pops are tops.
Oh.
And as soon as you remember it, you
yes.
remember it with both delight and horror.
Yes, yes. So I think that's so true.
I thought I'd ask Joyce Carol Oates to read this greasy, sugary section of The Lost Landscape. This is Joyce Carol Oates.
Food mysteries. Tootsie Roll, Mallow Cup, Milky Way, Junior Mint, Snickers, Hershey Bar, Mars Bar, O. Henry, Juicy Fruit, Dentine, Chewing Gum, Bubblegum, Jawbreaker, Hostess Cupcake, Chocolate with Cream Filling, Pies in Crinkly Wax Paper that Fit into the Palm of the Hand, to be devoured rapturously on the sidewalk outside the store in which they were purchased. Magical syllables, Tasty Freeze, Transit Road, Lockport. Orange, chocolate, cherry popsicles, slow melting at first and rapidly melting, fingernails sticky. Fudsicles, creamsicles, front of shirt stain, bare toes sticky. At the Royal, on Main Street, Lockport, hot fudge banana split with maraschino cherries, whipped cream, crown of sugar wafers. At Castle's Dairy on Main Street, Lockport, vanilla malt so thick you could barely drink it through a straw, strawberry milkshakes, double-dip ice cream cones, chocolate ice cream sandwiches. At Rexall's counter, chocolate Coke. Freddy's Donuts, glazed, chocolate, frosted cinnamon, sweet doughy filled to bursting with whipped cream, jelly, and covered in confectioner's sugar that leaves a guilty ghost smile on your face. Mayonnaise sandwich, mustard sandwich, peanut butter sandwich, bologna sandwich, Kraft American cheese sandwich, grilled cheese sandwiches, hamburgers, cheeseburgers, hot dogs, ketchup, mustard and relish, French fries, coleslaw, salty, sugary. Salty, buttery popcorn sold at Rialto Theater, hungrily devoured despite perennial rumors of rat droppings, cockroaches, and popcorn boxes. North Park Junior High Cafeteria, scorched macaroni and cheese casserole, Chef Boyardee spaghetti and tomato sauce, grease-encrusted French fries, beef doves, shepherd's pie, Texas hash, canned fruit cup, rice pudding, bread pudding, chocolate pudding, shiny, quivery red jello in fluted mold, pizza, cheese, tomato, green pepper, and coin-sized slices of pepperoni sausage glimmering with miniature pools of grease. Southern fried chicken, mashed potatoes with gravy pools, mashed potatoes with slow-melting wedges of butter cold from the refrigerator. Wonderful lost foods of childhood and adolescence. Where gone? How could we have eaten such heavy, unhealthy food? Happily, mostly.
Joyce Carol Oates reading a segment that could be a modern poem from The Lost Landscape, her memoir of a writer's coming of age. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel, The Man Without a Shadow. We'll continue after this short break.
Santa Monica Bay's public radio station, KCRW, relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates about her latest book, The Man Without a Shadow, the story of a neuroscientist who falls in love with her subject, a man without memory. Now, are you like me? That list didn't come with any effort, did it?
No, I could just rattle those things off. And I can remember the Southern fried chicken. My goodness. My mother would stand with the grease is sizzling in the skillet, and the chicken's put in, and the breadcrumbs. Can you imagine how many calories were in that? Like 5,000 calories?
And the mashed potatoes.
Mashed potatoes with much butter in them.
Butter on top,
yeah.
Pulled yellow on top of the white. Oh, it was
gravy pools in the mashed potatoes. That's what we all had.
But the effortlessness of the memory, the way in which those childhood things, do you think our childhood memories are sharper and more detailed than subsequent ones?
Oh, yes, definitely. But we have to evoke them. For instance, if you taste something that's evocative, a certain kind of cookie or a certain kind of, say, macaroni and cheese that your mother made, you have many, many memories. If you smell something like the lilacs that were blooming behind your house, that sense of smell is so potent, so powerful and primordial. And those memories are in your brain, deeply imprinted, but have to be evoked.
Now, Elihu has these memories from his childhood, perhaps not encyclopedic, because he's been during his life a businessman. Like many businessmen, he's put aside childhood things. But while he has no memory of the present, of things that have happened since his disease, he's able to talk with great charm and lucidity about his early life. Now, my mom is suffering from a kind of dementia, and she too, if I start to sing a Rodgers and Hammerstein song, she'll sing it with me.
Of course, that's wonderful.
She knows the things that she knew when she was young. This book is fascinating because in its opening pages, the sentences repeat themselves and create a kind of rhythmic, almost comforting sense of what is lost and cannot be found, but is nevertheless there, almost the way a song would be.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a particularly hard state to create in prose?
Oh, I wouldn't say it was any harder than most of my novels. Novels depend upon memory, depend upon the memory of the novelist. He or she has to keep many things in mind in writing. But memory is very elastic, too. You can improve your memory. The brain doesn't just deteriorate. The brain can also generate. There's a phenomenon called neurogenesis that's very much related to exercise. Walking and running are very, very good for the brain in ways that other exercises, including mental exercises, are not particularly helpful. So the brain is not passive. The brain is very elastic, and it can be aerated. It can be enlivened. As I said, new brain cells will grow if you exercise in the right way.
Do you find that writing itself is an aid to memory?
It is a fact. In a way that using a laptop or using a computer is not. That's actually a fact. I mean, neuroscientists have done experiments. Well, one of the wonderful things about writing a novel is that I read about all these experiments. And my husband, Charlie, who is a neuroscientist, has a library filled with books about neuroscience and the history of science and Darwinian evolutionary theory. And so I could just sort of look at his books. But the experiments that scientists devise are almost as imaginative and amazing as novels. They sit down and they think of these fantastic, this sort of like thought experiments, and then they execute them. But they're very original. Many of them are very imaginative.
Well, there was some frightening ones here,
yes.
Too.
The handshake.
The handshake, what was called the cruel handshake. A student shakes Eli's hand fiercely,
yes.
Very tightly. And by the third or fourth time, Eli, who has no memory, has an instinct, and he shakes the hand back fiercely, too. He grips.
Yes.
And he can't say why.
Why he's doing that.
Yes.
It's based on a real experiment. Say a person suffering from amnesia, you shake the hand, and there's something unpleasant about it. You're stinging. It could be a little thumbtack or something. And then 24 hours later, you do the same thing again. The amnesiac won't remember you and won't remember that and will shake your hand again. But maybe the third or fourth time when you do it, he will start to have some premonition that something's going to happen. Now, he doesn't know why. He's not remembering it consciously, but it's thought that there's a non-declarative memory. There's just something below the threshold of consciousness that he's maybe remembering. But the neuroscientists may disagree with that. Not everybody perhaps even thinks that's right.
But could you make that distinction between declarative and non-declarative memory for me?
Yeah, yes. If I give you a list of numerals or dates, or we talk about something in history with a lot of dates, you can make a conscious effort to remember it. You know, the Gettysburg Address was on this day, and Lincoln died on this day. You remember that. But it's easy to forget those dates because they're very specific. However, if I teach you to ride a bicycle and you're 8 years old, or swim and you're 12 years old, you're going to remember that. You just get in the water and you start swimming. Or say you're playing the piano, you're playing a piece that the last time you played it was 1979, and you played it pretty well. And now you sit down and you start playing, and suddenly your fingers are just finding the keys, and you're playing it. Now, you may make a few mistakes, but you keep on playing it because the memory is not conscious, it's non-declarative, it's deep inside the brain, and it's actually a very wonderful kind of experience.
Well, you remember hearing your father playing the piano in another room in your house, and when I was reading that, I thought, could it be that a novelist specializes in the construction of non-declarative imagery, that what is important perhaps in a novel is a stream of repetitions and variations that become for the reader not specifically educable, but nevertheless the temperature, the mood of the novel?
Yes, that's very beautifully put. That's beautiful. Yes, I think that's true. And much of writing and poetry and music and art is basically intuitive and unconscious. We feel that we're groping along, we're sort of wading through a deep water. We don't really know exactly where we're going.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I've been talking with Joyce Carol Oates. Her most recent book is The Man Without a Shadow, published by Echo. The previous book that contained that extraordinary list of bad foods is The Lost Landscape. The book that will come next is a book of horror stories, tales of terror, called The Doll Master, and it's from the Mysterious Press. I'm often fascinated by the things that Joyce Carol Oates discovers over her career as a writer. Joyce and I have been speaking, for nearly 40 years. It's a pleasure to see you again, as it always is.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Man Without a Shadow at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.